Welcome to Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School. So listen, learn, enjoy and share.
Welcome to another episode of the Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sarcy. Today, our guest is a woman who has had a successful leadership career in the male-dominated world of construction. Dr. Jessica Lautz is a prominent American economist and researcher. She is Deputy Chief Economist and Vice President of Research at the Chicago-based National Association of Realtors. The association represents more than 1.5 million estate agents and real estate professionals right across the USA. Dr. Lautz's work focuses on analysing trends in the American housing market, but her influence and her thought leadership extends beyond her research. She regularly features as an expert analyst on American television and other major news and industry platforms. Last year, she testified before the US Congress on housing policy and why young people are increasingly struggling to buy their first home. In America, Dr. Lautz has been named as one of Housing Wire's Women of Influence and one of RIS Media's Newsmakers, but she earned her doctorate in real estate here at Nottingham Trent University. So we are proud to welcome back Dr. Jessica Lautz for this episode of the Business Leaders Podcast.
Thank you. That was such a nice introduction. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm glad you are. So where are you and what time is it where you are?
So it's 10 a.m. and I am in Washington, D.C. So NAR has two offices. And so I'm in our second office, which is right next door to the U.S. Capitol, actually. I can see it out my window.
Oh, great stuff. That sounds all very exotic from where we're sitting. So you are Deputy Chief Economist with the NAR, which, as I said, is an organization that represents a million and a half real estate professionals in America. So just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So NAR is a trade organization. So you can opt in as a realtor to be part of this organization, and many do. You get education, you get advocacy, and importantly, you get research. And so we are producing information that hopefully can help our real estate professionals who are out there and help the industry really understand how people are grappling with housing affordability. What is the inventory situation? How many home sales are happening? How many first-time home buyers out there and young adults and seniors in the real estate market? How is everyone taking place? So that's what we're doing, is really producing that research for the benefit of realtors.
My goodness, you bring a lot of enthusiasm to it.
I love my work. I do. I love the research that we're doing, and I love sharing it with people and getting it off the shelf.
Great stuff. So it sounds like, as I understand it, I mean, I've been doing a bit of research and listening to other stuff that you've done, a lot of traveling, a lot of presenting. The whole of America is your patch. How do you stay fresh?
Yeah, no, this is a solid question. I actually just put together a count yesterday for my mid-year review, and I had done 34 presentations so far this year, and it's June 24th. So that's in person, and then a number of virtual as well. So
right across the country.
Yeah, all across the country. Yeah, absolutely. Taking a day trip from Washington, D.C. to California, which is essentially like taking a day trip to London. It's the same flight distance. So it's a little crazy sometimes. And I do get tired. I'm human. I'm not a robot. So staying fresh is an interesting question. Lots of water, I suppose, and coffee.
Okay, but you love what you do, quite clearly.
I do. And I think I stay energized by meeting the realtors, by hearing their experiences, by hearing what's going on in local markets. And every state in America is so completely different, and every local market is different. And so hearing that information, it brings a number to real life. And that's what I love doing.
Great stuff. So you're a researcher and an analyst by trade. I think I may have heard you describe yourself as a bit of a nerd. So what is effective leadership in the data-driven areas that you are, economics, housing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a big question. So, I mean, looking at leadership is so important. I have a team under me who's producing a lot of research, but they're also experts in different things. I have librarians and archivists on our team, and we have graphic designers, and you need to understand that everyone is bringing really unique skills into that to put out the best product. But I also think there's leadership when you're in front of a room and you're presenting this information. You are essentially a leader presenting that as the industry. I really believe in honesty and giving the honest truth of what's going on in the data. The home sales in America, and I think in your country as well, have really been lagging because a lot of people have low interest rate loans, so they have no encouragement to move. Home prices keep going up. And so when we look at sales, they're slower. And so I think telling people the truth when you're in front of a room is so incredibly important than sugarcoating things and telling them, oh, it's all great. That's not going to help anyone at the end of the day.
So is your leadership driven by values?
I think so. I think it is. I believe in trusting people and knowing that what people are doing out there really is for the good of the whole. I do think that about people, whether that's a practitioner in the field who's trying to sell a real estate and trying to make ends meet and have a transaction, or whether that's the people who I'm working with in the office, that they're trying to, on a daily basis, put out their best work that they can.
But that must be difficult in a sales environment where you're driven by those, by the need to generate business.
Sure, certainly. But I do think that real estate is different because when you're looking at residential real estate, you're looking at someone who's trying to find a home for their family, is trying to find a home for themselves, is driven by a change in their family situation, or just wanting to be close to their grandbabies. And so it suddenly becomes an emotional transaction versus one that's driven solely by dollars and cents.
So looking at your career, I mean, you've probably got a long career in front of you, but looking back on your career so far, have there been any pivotal moments, something maybe that shaped your leadership style?
Okay, so I was chatting about this question because you said the questions nicely in advance and I was stuck.
Oh, you've given away my secrets now.
I am sorry. I absolutely saw this question in advance and I thought, how in the world do I answer this? Because I don't think there's one moment, right? Your life is made up of all of these little moments. And so I was thinking about what has shaped me as in my style. And I thought maybe it's bad bosses that I've had. Maybe it's really horrible experiences.
And now you're going to say they were all men.
Well, I mean, yes, but just by happenstance, there's not many women leaders, right, in my field.
I was going to stop you there because I was going to bleed into something else that I just, before you just came on, maybe half an hour ago, I listened to you talking about something and I laughed out loud. You said you were at some event or a conference when it dawned on you that all the senior people were around you were men. And you thought, just a minute, I could do that. And that had inspired you. So I thought you were going to come out with that story.
Well, certainly that did, is that I have been in those rooms where it has been all men at the table, but bad bosses that I've had have certainly influenced me. I remember I got my annual review from one boss and he handed me my review and I looked at it and I'm reading through it and I'm reflecting on what he said. It was my colleague's work. Nothing on that piece of paper was mine. And we're still friends, the colleague and I, and we have lunch and we've talked about this. How she also was just looking at her review and we were just interchangeable to him. It did not matter. And so I think looking past that and understanding individual skills and leadership, you're horrified by the story, but this truly happened.
So, okay, well, I'm duty bound to say, okay, that was a pivotal moment. How did it actually shape your leadership style?
Well, I think I realized when I was going to be a supervisor, I would not do that. And I would put actual thought into what people are actually producing what they're doing and learn from them and meet with them on a regular basis in a regular cadence and also have an open door policy so that when they are stuck on an issue, we can chat about it and I actually understand what they're working on.
Okay. So joking apart, your industry is traditionally very male dominated. So how have you overcome that?
Ooh, that's a good question. So I will say that I think that research and economics is male dominated. There's a lot of men who are very successful in that. when we look at realtors, it is a woman-dominated field. We have seen that change over time, and there's more women leaders there. But I will say that when I get on a stage, I know that there may have been a lot of men who have come before me and talked to an audience like that. And the misogyny that I've seen in that is real. It's still happening. Just a couple of months ago, I was on a panel in a prep call, and it was with all men. It was going to be a male moderator, two male panelists, and myself. And they actually told me to be quiet in the pre-call, and that they were going to continue talking. So I never spoke. We got into the room and we're on stage, and I've sent my slides in advance. We're ready to go. And there's questions from the audience, like you would have on a panel. And they've asked, how did you produce that data? And so one of the men literally said out loud, I don't know, my assistant did my slides for me. I don't know how to do this. You'd have to ask her. And I said, okay, well, let me take the question that you had for him. I know how to answer it, and my questions. And I just answered all the rest of the questions. So I do think that karma, you can just let it roll.
Good God. And does that, I don't quite know what to say to that. Does that happen regularly?
I wouldn't say regularly, but this was just 2 months ago. So I will say that it still is quite active when we look at what does happen, unfortunately, that perhaps you come really prepared as a woman. And I think there's plenty of men who come extremely prepared too. But I do think that perhaps as a woman, you're over preparing, you're ready for any scenario. And sometimes you have your assistant do your slides for others. So
you feel you still have to be better.
I think there's a lot of women out there who do, and I'm not alone in that. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And again, I'm at the risk of repeating myself. How have you managed to get over that on a day-to-day basis?
I think karma eventually does happen. Right. Well, I think you can laugh at it too, right? You can tell the stories and you can say, well, I would never do that. And you can build on that experience. And I think also sharing those stories with other women, especially who work with me, that you learn from that and you say, oh, wow, okay, that's an interesting scenario, and let's learn what not to do here.
So now we're going to take a quick break from our chat to mention the MBA programs at Nottingham Business School. As we've learned from many of our guests, effective business leadership is about confidence, adaptability, and thinking strategically. These are the key ingredients to delivering innovation and impact in crowded, competitive markets. So if you are ready to transform your career, visit ntu.ac.uk/MBA to explore the MBA programmes at Nottingham Business School. We're one of only 1% of business schools worldwide who hold the prestigious Triple Crown accreditation. That's ntu.ac.uk/MBA to find out more. Now back to the show. So, leaving bad bosses aside for a moment, let's look at the good ones. So you work with a lot of, as you've already said, you work with people in a lot of different disciplines: analysts, economists, salespeople, policy professionals. Yeah. What are the overarching key traits of a successful leader? Something that draws them all together.
I think that when you're looking at someone who's successful, they're going to have an open door. They're going to inspire you. They're going to let you be in your skill sets. They're going to trust that they hired the best person for that job and that they're not actually an expert in that. And that's why you hired that person, to let them be and really be that expert. I think that's really important, is to have high expectations, but to also know you hired that person to do that job.
Right. Okay. And do good leaders always get some kind of a personal affinity, some kind of personal buy-in from their staff?
I think sometimes, but I don't necessarily know that that's required, right? So you want them to be committed. You want them to love and value what they're doing. And what I've certainly found is for newer, younger generations who are coming up, certainly they want to see the value and the mission behind things. But I don't necessarily know that that's always a requirement.
Okay. But that, you touch upon an interesting point there. You think that increasingly younger members of staff want to see stuff in the round. They want a broader picture of why they're doing what they're doing.
I do. I don't think that they just want to produce the widget. I think they want to understand what aspect of the widget they're working on, how that fits into the bigger picture, who's buying the widget, and what does that mean for them. And so I do think that they want a more holistic view than here's your task, do your task, clock out at 5 o'clock. I think that people are more engaged when they know that. And I think it's a new generation who's coming up who wants to understand the more holistic picture.
Okay. And have you had to adapt accordingly as a leader?
I have. And I also think having those one-on-one conversations with folks and talking to them about why this matters and what's going to happen with this afterwards, I think really does bridge that gap. And this is something that I think I've seen a bigger shift in the last 5 years or so. And maybe it's COVID has changed people and people have changed their priorities and they've changed their values and what's incredibly important to them and the time they're going to put into something. But I do think that this is a real shift in the workforce.
And is, I mean, you, as I say, I was marveling doing my research at how much traveling you actually do, but it occurs to me that you do a lot of face-to-face. Is that something that you're conscious about, or is it something that is demanded of you by your industry or your boss or whatever? Or is it something that you feel you have to eyeball people to get the message across?
People want in-person now. And that's definitely, that has always been the case, is that they want in-person presentations. But I think there is a value in that too, in having that in-person presentation where the disconnect of being on Zoom or being on Teams, it's there. And when you as a speaker are speaking into a void, you're speaking into a computer, you're not getting that feedback from people. You're not feeling if people are engaged or not. But also, I think that the audience feels that too. You as a speaker, it's easier to give and it's easier to connect with people, I think, in person.
Okay. And a lot of the stuff that you do is, this is definitely the wrong word, but I think you'll know what I mean, translation of complex data. That idea of you're taking numbers and analysis and you're trying to weave it into a story to get your point across that. I mean, you give evidence to politicians, you speak on television, you talk to newspapers, you talk on online platforms. How do you lead through communication? You know, what are your top tips on that?
Well, know your audience, certainly. I mean, that's a basic one, right? But I do think really understanding your audience is so incredibly important. Policymakers, members of Congress, they're going to understand what their constituents tell them. They're going to understand their own personal experience, but they're not going to understand that this is touching as a whole in the nation, affordability issues, the lack of housing inventory. They're not necessarily going to understand that. And so you need to get their buy-in. When you're talking to a realtor audience, they want to understand where they can find their next sale, where they can find their niche, where they can actually build on this and what they can learn. What's their opportunity? And they've come into a room, they've spent the time to get there and to take away from their business to hear you talk. So you better have something worthwhile to say. But I also think that when you're talking to the media, it's completely different. And so I can walk off a stage and then go to my hotel room and I've set up an ironing board so that I have the best angle of my face while I'm going to be on TV and the best lighting that I've tried to set up in a dreary hotel room and finding the best backdrop that I possibly can. And trust me, I've done this many times, last week included, and the lights are not working and you're just like, okay, I have to roll with it. But that audience is going to be so completely different than any of those others. And you have to talk to the broader public there.
And just for me to make sure I know what I'm talking about here, what you were describing there was an appearance on television, is that right? Where you're across Zoom or something of that nature, and you're in a hotel room and the cameras are rolling, as it were.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I've set up my laptop on an ironing board, perhaps on top of an ice bucket, so that I can have the best angle so that, you know, I can look beautiful on TV, right? So that's all part of it, too.
Right, I've got you. So going back to some of the meat of what you were just saying there, I read some of that evidence that you gave to Congress about American housing. It sounds as though similar issues, mortgages, rising, declining affordability, shifting demographics. Just, you know, as an aside, really, to the leadership, what are the issues that you spend your time talking about?
I mean, really, I'm talking about right now the divide in real estate. So we have a lot of people who are seniors and they've been in their homes for many years and they have a lot of housing equity and they've earned this through price appreciation. As home prices go up, they're sitting on a lot of housing wealth. And then we have this divided nation right now of people who are young adults who are struggling to get into homeownership, who are seeing home prices go up, interest rates are higher, they're unable to find an affordable property. And so it really is the tale of two cities when we look at the real estate market today. And I think that is universal from what I've heard about the UK real estate market and what I've seen. It seems to be a thread that really is true in both nations.
And where's it going, do you think?
Well, I think the good thing is policymakers do understand that this is a problem, but I think everyone wants to find a different solution to it. And for the US, it is building more affordable housing inventory. But that often comes down to local regulations and local laws. And so then you have to convince local folks that this is important. And the person who shows up to the city council meeting is someone who doesn't want building. And so we're fighting against NIMBYism in many local communities, not in my backyard. So that becomes an even bigger issue, too.
So the situations are similar for both countries. Yeah. Okay. So... what you're describing there, the great market uncertainty, what principles, leadership principles, are guiding your decision making in this time, and the recommendations that you make to 1.5 million estate agents?
Yeah, I mean, I think just basing them in facts and making sure that you're making fact-based recommendations, that if we had more inventory, then we would have more first-time homebuyers. When we're seeing the data, and the data is telling us that first-time homebuyers are at an all-time low, and their age is at an all-time high, they're 38 years old before they go to purchase their first home, and they used to be 28, 40 years ago, we know we have an issue, and that they're not going to build on that housing wealth. But I also think you have to get that buy-in of what does that mean for you? And is it the multiplier effect that not only does that individual earn housing wealth in their lifetime and that allows them to move up, but also in your local community, what is the economic benefit? What is your buy-in as a council person? What is your buy-in to have this happen in more building? And so you have to really base it in fact and tell the truth when you're doing that, I think.
Okay. You just touched on community there, and I know that outside of what you do, and your leadership extends out into the community. I've read about some of the stuff that you do with non-profit community organisations. A lot of leaders and people in your own position do that kind of thing. I particularly like your, I hadn't heard this one before, Cakes for Kids rule, where the kids who wouldn't get a birthday cake, you bake one and take that around there. That sounds great. So how has this kind of work influenced your leadership approach in your professional role?
Yeah, well, it's a creative outlet. It's certainly a hobby. But also, I think that for folks who are listening to this podcast, many of us are privileged, right? If you have the ability to listen to a podcast, you have the time, you have the resources to do that, you likely are coming from a point of privilege as opposed to someone who's not. And I think it's a good thing to check ourselves every once in a while and keep me grounded and say, this kiddo's not going to have a birthday cake because they're in a shelter right now, a domestic violence shelter or homeless shelter. They're in a temporary living situation with foster parents. And making a birthday cake is the simplest thing you can possibly do to give back. And sometimes it makes me tear up when I'm delivering it and I get the photo of the kid with the birthday cake. I mean, I'm just all tears, but it does make you feel good when you do that.
And that makes you a better leader everywhere.
Yeah. I hope so.
So, finally, as you know, this is a podcast for Nottingham Trent University, Nottingham Business School. If you could give one piece of advice to aspiring leaders in real estate, in construction, in business, anywhere, what might it be and why?
I would say to be nerdy. You all have your own nerdy thing. You all love your own nerdy thing. And I think that many people, you know, they may hesitate in doing that and really dig in harder. And I think being the most educated person on that topic is not going to hurt you. And other people want to know about it. They want to learn about your nerdy thing and don't hesitate from telling them about it.
That's fantastic. Nobody has ever said that before. and be a nerd. Superb. Dr. Jessica Louts, it's been an absolute privilege to have you on the Business Leaders Podcast. Thanks very, very much.
Thank you. This has been wonderful.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with Dr. Jessica Louts, why not listen to previous episodes with the former chief executive of the Financial Ombudsman Service, Caroline Wyman, the co-founder of the amazing IF company, Sarah Ellis, or the chair of the Football Association, Debbie Hewitt, MBE. This episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast was produced by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.